You're listening to All Things Considered here on Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Aaron Selbig. Bela Fleck is widely considered the best banjo player in the world. He's known for taking the instrument in new and unexpected musical directions. Chris Thiele is a virtuoso on the mandolin. He's made a name for himself with his bands Nickel Creek and the Punch Brothers. And later this fall, he'll take over as the new host of Prairie Home Companion. The two artists have joined forces for a week-long U.S. tour. They play tonight at Kresge Auditorium here at Interlochen Center for the Arts. And we're very pleased to have both of them here in the studio with us today. Mr. Fleck, Mr. Thiele, welcome to Interlochen. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah.
Good to be here. Beautiful.
Yeah.
I must say, this is a lot of talent and star power in one room together. How did this idea for a duo tour come together?
It came together in my mind when I was 14 years old. but that was a long time ago.
And how old are you now? 16?
I don't know what the actual percentages, the likeliness of that happening.
When you were a kid, dream of playing with Bela Fleck?
Absolutely. Doing duets. I learned all the Flecktones tunes and was just ready. I think in my mind there was some possibility of Bela just calling and going, "Hey, one of the guys is sick, can you join?" You know, and I would come roaring out there triumphantly knowing all the tunes. That was in my head, of course.
How did it turn out in real life?
Well, the first time was Merlefest. How old are you, 14?
Yeah, 14 or 15.
Yeah.
I think I was 15 for that thing, that jam.
Yeah. Did we meet before that? I don't think so. That was the first time you crossed my awareness, and it was like, wow, it's pretty amazing bluegrass player, because that's all we played on that jam when you came out and played a couple of tunes with us. Mm-hmm. And then he just kept coming on. Yeah, and the more and more facets got shown. Till it was like, wow, this is like the cat that's bringing the music forward now. So it's exciting to get to play with him.
This tour, this is the first time you've done something like this as a duo going on tour?
Yeah, we've had all these glancing interactions. Like, we've sat in with each other bands, both Flecktones and Pagosa Springs, I think, was the first time you got up and just played a bunch. It was a low-key festival in Colorado, and Chris came out and we just had a great interaction. And then pretty much any time he was there, we'd come up for something. And I've sat in with Nickel Creek and Punch Brothers, and I'm a big fan of their banjo player, who I first met when he was a lot younger than when I met Chris, just a little guy, Noam Pikelny. It was just neat that people have listened to what we do, like guys like me and Sam Bush and Mark O'Connor and Edgar Meyer, Jerry Douglas, all the guys like us, and taken it to their own place. Because it never seemed that clear that was going to happen when we were kind of creating our own musical directions.
Your first show on this tour was the other night in Omaha, and I saw a review of that show that said the show felt like peeking into a living room where two old friends are playing together. Is that what it feels like for you guys when you're on stage?
It's remarkably comfortable. That's been the thing from the first time we ever sat down together and played, is we could just go. We start playing and didn't have to say anything, and we could play for an hour and go into the ether. And part of it is he's so familiar with my language, and then he's building on it, so it inspires me, because I'm like, oh, I didn't know you could do that with this, with my stuff. And so then I go, oh, well, then maybe if he can do that, then maybe I can do this. And it's all happening in your synapses so fast that it's unconscious pretty much. And those kinds of sparks don't happen with everybody. They're very rare. So
it's wonderful to share musical dialect. You can, if someone speaks exactly the same language that you do, you can start saying things that you didn't know you thought, in a way that I think, the kind of conversation you can have with someone where there's a little bit of a language barrier. Maybe you can both, for me, only speaking English, for instance, the kind of conversation, the depth of conversation I can have with someone who speaks a little English, is different from someone who speaks perfect English. And I think with Bela, it's like we don't only just speak English together. It's like we speak the same dialect. Hmm.
We can go immediately to more advanced concepts. We don't have to figure out what the means. Hmm. Or A means.
Yeah, is that kind of interaction happening on stage during a show?
Oh, for sure.
Oh, yeah.
For sure. Especially what's fun right now is with both of us being the kind of musicians who, you know, we both like to plan. We're both planners. Mm-hmm. But we also both really love to improvise. And I think sometimes left to our own devices, we'll occasionally plan. We can plan some of the spontaneity out. I know I can.
Right.
I can. I'm guilty of occasionally just, you know, getting sort of nerding out on some concept that forgets to leave room for magic to happen in the moment. And I think we've both been conscious of that tendency in each other's musicianship, and have left some room for things to happen.
I would even say that's kind of the battle in each of us is how much to leave to chance or the moment and how much to plan. Because the thing about improvising is you can't really count on it unless you leave yourself no other option.
Yeah.
Like I've heard Herbie Hancock talk about surrendering to the moment and people talking about how it's very brave to walk out there with nothing. And we did that a couple of times. I thought you were one of the...
A couple festival sets. The only like official duo activity before this was actually almost 100% improvised sets at festivals.
Because we wanted to see if we could just walk out there and plan nothing. And it is a brave thing to do. It's very frightening. And I think after the first time we did it, we were both so soaking wet with sweat. Like, we could sit in a room for 2 hours or whatever and play nonstop and not get tired. But out on stage trying to, like, generate pure improvised, you know, coolness for that long. Just we both finished in WoW. Wow, we're not doing that again. That was enough of that. And listening back to it, you know, quite a lot of it was pretty interesting.
Yeah.
And we did it again at Telluride, and we made a few little plans. Like, well, after about 20 minutes, let's play this chord, or we'll fall into that little riff, or maybe we'll actually hit this.
Landing spots.
We had landing spots, and that went a lot easier. Actually,
like the people in the Tour de France, you know, we had basically the little things that we had planned were like the cups of Gatorade people were passing to us as we would ride by.
Yeah, like when we get to 20 minutes in, let's both go into harmonics, and that'll be something to look forward to. So we don't just play the same sort of thing all the way through. And that was a lot of fun.
But this set we have you know, there's a set list. But again, much is left open to chance. You know, I bet you if you go and look at how long the songs are from night to night, it'll be fairly different. Just based on whatever we get into that night, and making sure that regardless of what might be planned, that there are plenty of question marks left.
Yeah.
So that's fun for everyone, I think, to know that what's happening that night will never happen again. And live music is always that way, because even if you play everything, you know, ostensibly note for note, the way in which you play it will change depending on where you are, and people's impressions of it will change given who they are. But this is a fun way to go about it. Whoever comes to that beautiful outdoor auditorium tonight, whoever comes there, should know that they're going to impact the music that night. Like, we'll play differently because of who's there. We were just talking about trying to make sure there's as many young people there as possible. That's mm-hmm. always exciting.
Yeah, they're the only ones that are going to hear that concert. It's not the same concert the next night.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that good review you saw from Omaha, uh-huh. take it with a grain of salt, man.
Yeah, there's no guarantees.
Don't know.
Here.
No guarantees.
It changes every night. Both of you have recorded a big range of music, bluegrass and classical and jazz. And is there anything that you haven't done yet artistically that you'd like to? I don't know, Norwegian death metal or anything.
none of them seem that different to me. It doesn't seem like it's I certainly don't look at it as like, oh, now I want to try this kind of music. For me, it's just like, oh, that's great. What's that? How does that work? And then the more you dive in there and try and figure out what makes the machine work, you know, you take it apart and realize it's all built with the same stuff. And it's really, they're different on the outside, but it's like judging a book by its cover. You see bluegrass instruments and expect it's going to sound like Bill Monroe. That's a pretty wild assumption to make, actually. And if you see, I mean, think about how different the music that you can hear out of like two guitars, bass, and drums, which kind of is the string quartet of our day, as far as like how much music is being made with that ensemble, and just how different it can all be. I mean, you know, the Strokes are two guitars, bass, and drums, and so is Radiohead. You know, that's
and the Beatles
and the Beatles. That's wildly different music. So just because they're made with the same instruments doesn't mean they're anything close to similar. They're certainly no more similar than like a symphony is from you know, a Radiohead record, in my opinion.
So are you always incorporating things that you hear from maybe other parts of the world or other styles of music into your playing?
I think my answer to all of that is it's all an organic process. So rather than going, hey, I'm gunning for this, like I want to make sure I don't forget to play with, you know, a ukulele player from Antarctica. I don't think that way, but if I run into a great musician and I'm intrigued by them and we become friends and I start to like their music and we start playing together, then it could turn into a real serious collaboration. Yeah. But I think that's true also with incorporating things. I don't go, hey, how can I get a reggae beat into my bluegrass song? I don't like to think that way. I prefer to like play and see what comes up, yeah. and then when things come up, make note of them, and then figure out how you can take them and make them individual and make them express your personality and your point of view as a musician.
Chris, how were you originally attracted to bluegrass music and the mandolin?
It was around. My parents started taking. They were voracious public radio listeners. So kind of everything that was on public radio at the time was in me. I mean, I liken this stuff to you know, the early lesson everyone learns about flamingos, you know, and how they're pink because they eat a ton of shrimp, and the pigment in the dye, you know, it actually colors them. And I feel that musicians are that way, that what you listen to, it comes out. It's in there. It's part of what you have to draw from. So I think that early experience of, you know, just the day's programming on public radio, and then my parents' record collection, which was a lot of folk.
Where was that? Was that in Kentucky?
That was in Southern California.
And there was a lot of bluegrass and acoustic music on and around there.
San Diego County had a thriving acoustic scene, but of course it wasn't, you know, it wasn't the same as the scene you might find in, you know, Louisville, Kentucky.
How old were you when you started playing?
Five.
Five.
Yeah, but I started begging for a mandolin when I was two. They were taking me to this pizza place, and there was live music there every week. The leader of the band played mandolin, and I wanted very badly to do what he did, but not necessarily because of the instrument, more because of the guy. The guy was you know, he's this very charismatic, magnetic fellow, and I wanted to be like him, and he played the mandolin, so there, you know, there it was.
Bela, what about you? What made you pick up a banjo?
Well, there was nothing to do with that kind of music in my world. I grew up in New York City on 100th Street in West End, and my grandparents had lived in Queens, and I remember going to see them probably around that age, that four or five years old. I don't exactly know when it was, but this memory of they letting us watch TV and the Beverly Hillbillies came on, and that sound of that banjo just...
In the theme
blew
song.
Me away, and it turns out to be the greatest banjo player of them all, Earl Scruggs, who has the ability to turn an unactivated banjo player into a foaming at the mouth person looking for a banjo and changing their lives. And every serious banjo player that I know of, or most of them that I have had their aha Earl Scruggs moment, and it's always Earl. It's never another banjo player who makes them go into a type A, you know, personality change. But that's what happened to me, and ever since I heard that, from the time I heard that, my radar was out for banjo. But it's an instrument that you listen to it and you go, well, nobody can ever play that instrument. It's impossible. So it's so incredible. No, you know, I never thought I could ever play it, basically. So I never went and got one. But my mom got me a guitar, and I played a few Beatles songs and some folk songs, and I was a kid that was sort of interested in the guitar, interested in music, you know. But then when I was 15, I was just getting ready to go to high school the weekend before high school started. And I went to see my grandfather, who had moved to Peekskill, New York. And he said, hey, I found this at a garage sale, and it was a banjo. And I was like, I couldn't believe it. It had just fallen into my lap out of the sky, and that was what I'd always wanted in the first place. So I just kind of freaked out. And then on the train home from Peekskill to New York, I ran into a guy who tuned it up for me who played the banjo. And so I ended up back in the city, you know, the night before high school started with this banjo that was in tune. And I just... all I could do is play it.
Awesome.
All I could do is play it.
Did you ever learn to play the Beverly Hillbillies
theme song? Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Maybe we could hear a little bit of it.
If you're ready, something like that. Earl does it better.
I wonder, as long as you've got your banjo out and your mandolin, maybe you'd play another song, perhaps something that folks might hear tonight at Kresge Auditorium.
Should we do Up and Running first?
Oh, yes. Yes, let's do Up and Running.
Okay. Thank you.
So that was that's a song of Bela's off a record he made called Tales from the Acoustic Planet. And earlier when I mentioned fantasizing about an eventual Bela and me duo, that record was huge in cultivating that fantasy for me. I learned every song off of it, and sometimes not just the songs, but the solos,
everything. I remember,
and not just the mandolin solos, but all the solos.
Right. I remember we were backstage at Telluride once, and you said, "Hey, can you play that whatever song?" And I just from that record, and I started playing it, and he played my solo to it, which I didn't remember. And I don't think you had actually learned. It was just all in your consciousness. Did you actually learn all the solos?
Some of them were just in there because I'd listen to. I mean, I would listen to it. There were a month or two in there where it was. I probably listened to it 3 or 4 times a day, you know. And I would, and then sometimes would get in there and you know, okay, now I'm going to learn this song. I remember learning the Bicyclops.
Oh wow!
And you know, getting in that was more involved. My parents didn't see me for 7 or 8 hours. I remember when it was Christmas Eve. The Bicyclops is a fairly involved thing that Bela wrote to play with Chick Corea, the great pianist. And I remember not being able to count it. I couldn't count it. And I think you even had in your notes that it was in 6.
Yeah.
And I couldn't find it. And I wasn't listening to it, but it was Christmas Eve, and it was going through my head, and I remember finding it in my head. It was like, oh, it's there. And I remember jumping up, you know, as if I had heard reindeer or something, and like jumping up and running to my stereo and putting this song on and counting to 6 and feeling like I had just won Wimbledon or something. then spent Christmas actually playing it now that I knew it was in 6. But that was kind of, that was a seminal record for me. Yeah. One, two, three, four, five, six. 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 But like, Chick's doing all this crazy stuff to kind of obscure the 6. And I don't know, you know, it's hard enough to find with just your part, because it's definitely, it's a trippy 6.
What kind of music do you guys listen to in the car lately, or when you're hanging out at home making dinner or whatever?
Well, Chris listens to a lot of, like, with his new duties, you know, as the host, it seems like you're just soaking up. So you always have listened to a ton of music. There's so much stuff to be aware of and to figure out who's going to be on the show and who you want to, you know, collaborate with for that kind of stuff. And I find, now we're both parents too, which is a neat thing that we're sharing. I have a 3-year-old and Chris has a 1-year-old. And in my 3-year-old experience, I don't feel like I have any time to listen to music. I have time to work on music because I have to fight and make that. But I don't listen to much music anymore. I know I will again. But if I did, I'd probably be listening to classical stuff like Bartok, Brahms, things that I don't know that well that are fascinating to me that I can learn from, because I've been writing these banjo concertos and trying to just soak up something about what these composers bring and how they do it.
There's a lot of catch up in that world for both of us, I think.
The classical world?
Yeah. There's so much beautiful, beautiful music there. There's just piles of it, piles of extraordinary music to sift through. You know, in the way, you know how you go to like the Metropolitan Museum of Art or something like that, and you have 25 masterpieces screaming at you in one room. And it's hard. It's hard sometimes. You know, they're all so good, and these great masters, you know, spent weeks, months, years sometimes working on something. And you're just in there, and they're all in one room. It's really overwhelming. So there's a process of you know, it's all well and good for a musician to say, oh, here, you should check out, you know, you need to check out Bach and Mozart and Beethoven and Brahms and Bartok and Debussy, and you know, you need to get all these things. And then to have these streaming services where you actually can do, you could sit down and listen to it all. It's like the masterpieces in the room screaming at you, and you gotta find time.
It's too much.
There's so much there, and I remember what I'll do is I get really obsessed with a certain piece. Like I remember finding Bartok's Concerto for Orchestra and just listening to it over and over and over again, kind of like I would do with your stuff, and you know, or Debussy's string quartet, and just really, really some piece will, for whatever reason, it just leaps out at me, and that'll be it. Recently, Radiohead's A Moon-Shaped Pool. I think it's just a tremendous Radiohead record. I was already a fan. But this record really strikes me as being a, there's not like one song off it that I would say, oh, listen to this song and you'll get what the record is about. It's kind of a top to bottom listen. You need to really dive in there and listen to it from start to finish to kind of get into it. I love that.
And one of the few bands I really follow and listen to a lot is Chris's band, is Punch Brothers. And I'll take it and I'll go for runs, you know, or things like that. I did a lot. I feel like I know those records about as well as anything I've gotten to know in recent years, maybe because it's just close enough to me but different that it's intriguing to me. And I just love to hear that somebody's pursuing those avenues and so well. So,
which I still haven't fully processed this. The 14-year-old me is preventing me from actually absorbing the fact that you listen to my records on your runs.
Well, there isn't much out there that I like, to tell you the truth. I mean, I think you like a lot more because you go listen, you go out and get involved out about stuff, and then you find out about there's a lot of great stuff. I just haven't had the time to go out and dig it out.
It's fun how the Prairie Home thing is actually forcing my hand on that a little bit, because you're right, when Calvin showed up, there's just a lot.
That's your
of
son?
Hours. Yeah, my little boy. When he showed up, there's just a lot of hours spoken for all of a sudden that were previously spoken for by just.
I want to ask you about that, Chris. You're a busy man. You're performing with Bela and the Punch Brothers. You're recording all the time. You're getting ready to take over Prairie Home Companion in the fall. And as you mentioned, you have a family. You have a young son at home. How do you manage all of that time? How do you find time to make adequate time for everything that's going on in your life?
I'll let you know at the end of this year.
Is it Google Calendar, or do you have a personal assistant? There must be some secret.
I definitely have a very hardworking manager who helps me. So far, we haven't run into an iceberg yet.
Well, you're doing it at a more normal age. Like, I'm doing it a lot later because I'm 20-something years older than you. And I'm fortunate that I'm getting to have a child at this point when I've done so much that if I took a couple of years off and didn't do anything, it wouldn't really hurt my career, you know? And so I've changed my career for this time in my life, but you're in a different place. You're in like your golden, like go get it done period. So he's doing a lot. You're doing a lot, but I see that commitment when he gets home to creating that space. And luckily you've got the support there at home.
Yeah. Yeah. My wife is an extraordinary person who manages to somehow keep him from dying and also keep me from dying,
which is the ultimate goal of parenting.
Yes. Yeah. And also, she has a thriving professional life of her own that she's also doing right by. It's so anytime I think I've got a lot to deal with, I just look at her. You know, the story of the farmer and his wife, where he's like, oh, if you had to do what I did, you couldn't hang. And of course, she can do all of it and more. He tries to do what she does for one day and just about.
Well, you're fixing to add to the to-do list in October, I believe it is. You're going to take over as host of Prairie Home Companion. I know I don't have to tell you that show has been a staple of public radio for decades. Tell us a little bit about the preparation that's going on for the show, and what will Prairie Home Companion listeners hear when they tune in to their new host?
Well, I think the show's format is profound. This template that Garrison created is I'll bring up the string quartet again, which I consider to be kind of maybe the greatest ensemble. The way that the string quartet functions is just so satisfying, even as it's surprising. And I think Prairie Home actually works a little bit like that. It, this swirling mass of various forms of entertainment. They propel each other forward, and the 2 hours just vanish. It just goes by in a heartbeat. You know, with roughly half music and half other, whatever that may be, comedy and storytelling and things like that. So that won't change. The format won't change. Certainly, the scope of the music will change. Just how I, you know, Garrison's always had a wide window of interest for sure. But you know, he's 73. I'm 35. That is kind of a change inherent in that. And then he's one of the world's greatest storytellers of all time. And I am not one of the world's greatest storytellers of all time. I'll still talk. I love talking to people, but I certainly won't tell like Wobegon stories. So we'll find other means of inducing laughter. There'll still be scripts, there'll still be fake commercials, and there'll be lots of music. Roughly the same amount.
So this kind of the skeleton of the show will be similar. There'll be characters, there'll be plenty of comedy, there'll be ad spoofs and that sort of thing.
There'll be a little bit more collaboration.
You haven't told them about the reveal yet about the interpretive dance portion of the show?
Yeah, it's going to be really, really solid on the radio. You know, really, really engage people's imaginations with all this dead air during which we're prancing around the stage. It's going to be fantastic.
Consider putting in a pool and having some synchronized swimming as well. That might be not a bad idea.
Don't blow it.
Have you guys played with young musicians in your career?
I'm here right now.
Yeah, I guess. other than Chris.
So am I, Bayless. So am I.
That have later gone on to become career musicians. This is kind of the opposite of the standard question of who are your influences. Who have you influenced? Who have you, you know, is there a young musician that you felt like you've had an influence on that has later gone on and done great things in your mind?
Are you asking me? Well, I mean, Chris is a prime example, and I also see it with him. I see he's changed the face of the mandolin. There's all these young people that want to play the mandolin that think mandolin is cool because they saw Chris. When Chris came in, Sam Bush was cool, and he got legions of people to come along, and he's part of what created guys like Chris. Although there aren't a lot of guys like Chris, there's a whole lot of young... The level of the mandolin has raised due to Chris's playing and his impact. Just the way the fiddle changed when Mark O'Connor came on the scene. I mean, he changed the level that was acceptable to play the fiddle. Now you have to play it in tune. You have, when you go up the neck, it has to be, you know, it has to have a feel, all that kind of stuff that he could do, this sort of elegance that he could bring to fiddling. Now that's expected, you know. So I see that with you.
Maybe, Chris, we could hear one of your songs. Perhaps you'd be willing to sing for us?
I would be willing. Okay. I would be willing. Yeah, the singing. I'm a sing... kind of a sing second, play first guy, but in our little duo, we've been having fun kind of breaking up the playing with a little bit of singing. Almost the opposite of many ensembles, MO, you know, you might have an instrumental song to kind of be a palate cleanser. Uh-huh. And for us, I think the vocals are...
It's the opposite?
The vocals are our palate cleanser. This is a tune, a Punch Brothers tune. So something the boys and I wrote. Actually... inspired by Mad Men. It's sort of a song about Don Draper called No Concern of Yours. It's no concern of yours. A word can break as easy as it's spoken, snarled or sworn. And it's no concern of yours, my friends. It's no concern of yours. And it's hard to hold your head up when it's in your hands to wash off last night's trouble. in a clean white shirt, but if anyone can do it, I can. And it's no concern of yours, my friends. It's no concern of yours. The finest looking apple can be rotten to the core. And it's no concern of yours, my friends. It's no concern of yours. We're not here to talk about me. We're here to get things done. 'Cause if we do, my daddy won't have ruined both his sons. He's going down. My friends, it's no concern of yours. The nail that's sticking up will just be hammered to the board. And it's no concern of yours, my friends. It's no concern of yours. When your name is on this building, take me out for lunch after three or four old fashions. Tell me what you've heard, then you'd better listen closely. I'll only say this once.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you.
You guys have both talked about having young children at home. I want to put this to both of you. Chris, I'll start with you. Has becoming a father affected your music?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, a lot, a lot. All the stakes are higher, is what I would say. I think... For me, it's I guess music for me is, I've always just been sort of like in this fantasy world with it, where I'm there's something theoretical about the whole pursuit somehow that I mean I love it. I love every second of it, but I don't necessarily feel like I've always tied it to you know, I know a lot of people like using their music for a certain purpose, like to make the world a better, safer, happier, you know, more fair place, and fairer place. And just for me, it's always just been pure music, just for the love of it. Just I love when that sound happens. I'm tickled pink when that sound happens. And it's like this, I guess, almost hedonistic pursuit of just my own delight and pleasure in the various devices, musical devices that are available to me and to anyone who looks for them. And I think since Calvin came along, it's almost like now I feel like I'm playing for keeps somehow. Like now it's almost like applying this to actual life. And this is what I've got. It's all I've done. This is what I can do. And so now that's what I am doing for him. And now think of it as like he's inherited this world from us and we've messed it up pretty good. You know, we've made it tangibly hotter. Species are dying out. The, you know, the air quality is lower. And like, this is the world I'm giving my son. And it's not as good as the world that I was given. And so now I feel like I need to do something to make it better for him. And then as soon as I start thinking about that, instead of just the pursuit of my own pure musical enjoyment, like that it just delights me like an addict. We were talking about this.
It's like a healthy addiction. Mm-hmm. If you can get to where this kind of obsessive thing where you just get up and you want to play and you want to write and then you want to go perform and you just get, because of that, all the time you spend and that focus, you get really good at it and it turns into like a healthy, you know, people wouldn't consider it unhealthy unless someone's getting hurt by it, you know.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Has having a child changed your music, Ben?
I don't play as much. You know, there's times where, well, here's the thing. Like Chris, the music is everything to me, and like Chris, the notes are it. I'm not trying. If there's any kind of social impact of it, it's not because I'm trying to create a social impact. It's because it's a natural outgrowth of what I'm doing, and it makes people feel a certain way or feel inspired or whatever it is that they walk away with. And I'm thrilled that anybody ever says, hey, that music helped me through a tough time, yeah, or hey, we took your music to the Arctic, or you know, or whatever, and it got us through whatever. Whenever I hear anything where the music that I created because it made me feel whole made somebody else's life better, I go, thank goodness it's not just about me.
Yeah.
But the truth is, I don't think if you talked about Picasso and you said, you know, what was he trying to do for people? He was trying to satisfy himself as an artist, and then the outgrowth of his work had all this impact. And so I think it's actually, you have to give yourself permission to be selfish in certain parts of your life, because art is not created by committee. It's not. It's got to be created by somebody following their muse, and their muse means it sounds good to you, it looks good to you, it's your art. So being in a world where that's okay and is actually a wonderful thing, we're always really excited when we see somebody do something really well. It makes us all feel better about the whole thing. Yeah. So that hasn't really changed, but I still feel like it's really important that I don't let up on my focus of being the musician I want to be just because I'm a parent, because I don't want to show Juno that it's okay to not follow your dreams or to be less than you can be. I want him to look at me and go, oh, you know, Papa was always really trying hard to be the best he could be, and I think that I want to be the best I can be. And also to show him that both Mama and Papa, their lives, the things that they do outside of raising him are also important, because I want him to have a healthy relationship when he is ready for it, where he can have a partner and support each other and help each other achieve their dreams. So I think there's things like that come to mind that I never thought about before. Before it was just, where's the banjo? I want to play. Give me more.
I think it's so tempting to vilify humanity wholesale right now, that we treat each other poorly, we treat our environment poorly. It's kind of a dark time. Like what we fear each other, and I think that that art is a way to remind ourselves of the beauty that humanity is capable of producing, and actually is inclined to produce, and can even represent our best intentions towards each other and towards our world. And and so I think I haven't thought much about that, just because it made me, because it scared me. And then Calvin came along, and I feel like now I actually have an obligation to think about it, because I got to try and make sure that that the world that I give him gives him the best chance at happiness possible.
Chris Thiele and Bela Fleck are performing together tonight at 8 p.m. at Kresge Auditorium here at Interlaken Center for the Arts. Gentlemen, it was a pleasure. Thank you so much for being here today. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.